Hi, I'm Stacey Shoemaker-Rowan, Editor-in-Chief of Hospitality Design Magazine with HD's What I've Learned podcast. In November, during ICFF and Wanna Design Manhattan, I had the pleasure to speak to the talented Ini Arkaban. His work transcends disciplines. He's crafted furniture for the likes of Bernhardt Design and Knoll. He's designed a watch collection for French luxury brand Hermès. He conceived the Pavilion of the African Diaspora for the London Design Biennale, and recently landed his first solo gallery exhibition in New York, scored with his own music. Our candid conversation dove into Ini's process, which is centered on storytelling that combines empathy, philosophy, spirituality, and everything in between. Ini says there are no boundaries on his work, allowing him to be creative in any realm. Hi, everyone. I'm Stacey Shoemaker-Rowan. I am the Senior Vice President of Design of the Design Group at Emerald, which oversees ICFF and BDNY. So thank you so much for being here today. Hope everyone's having an amazing show. I'm super honored to be sitting here with Ini Arkaban. Thank you so much for joining me today. And we're just going to have a nice little chat about his work and his career, and then we'll open up for questions at the end. So if you have any for Ini. So, Ini, how are you? I think you're live.
Am I good? All right.
So there's such great legacy here with you. How did your career start? Well, let's go back. Were you always a creative person growing up? Was this something you always wanted to do?
Yeah, I was always creative. I never saw it as, you know, my career path or anything like that. It was always just something that it was always a part of my life. Right. So I was always building little worlds, playing with Legos and micro machines, like I think everybody did back then. And eventually when I started going to art classes, it kind of consumed my life. But I never took it seriously beyond just being good at art and enjoying it. And to this day, I feel lucky that it's my career, honestly.
When did you, quote unquote, take it seriously? Like, when did it turn into something bigger than you thought?
20 years old, I think. I had a pretty conventional upbringing, you know, very academic, you know, go to school, go to college, get a job. That was kind of what my parents hoped for me. And I severely disappointed them.
I don't think so.
When I dropped out of school and told them that I was going to be some kind of artist. And, you know, it was kind of a rough period, but I think all great things, you know, happen in those moments. So for me, it was making a firm decision to dedicate my life to creativity that I think gave me the, you know, the drive to really make something out of my creativity.
And you have such, as I started to say, you have such legacy here with the show. Talk to us about, you know, the first time you came here and you were on exhibit.
Yeah, so, wow. So it was 2010 or 2011. And I'd been coming to ICFF. I had my first piece with Bernhardt Design, and I had won an award from the American Design Honors. And I sat down with Claire of Wanted Design and Mark Thorpe, who's standing right there on his phone. And we went to dinner one night, and I was showing them this chair, the renderings of this chair, and a couple other pieces that I'd made that weren't quite commercial, you could say. You know, I'd done the Bernhardt piece, and I, you know, been coming to ICFF, and I had been selected for ICFF Studio, and I was showing, you know, again, more kind of contract furniture, and I'd been making this kind of stuff, and there wasn't at the time really an outlet for that. You know, there was there weren't like the collectible design fairs like there are now, and you know, even at school, making stuff like this, I was kind of looked at kind of with the side eye, with my teachers wondering how I would ever sell something like that to a company. And when I sat down with Mark and Claire, you know, Claire was very clear. She was like, we have this thing we want to design, and this is exactly what would work. You know, there's a place for this. And, you know, that got me really excited. And then I found out that it cost money. At the time, you know, Kickstarter was a thing. So I created a Kickstarter that literally said, Eni needs to go to Wanted Design in NYC. And I showed like the process of making this chair and a couple other pieces. And the rewards were basically autographed renderings and miniature 3D models of the furniture. And the Kickstarter succeeded in like a week. And that made me able to bring this to Wanted Design. And this is exactly the chair that I presented almost 10 years ago, plus a bit of wear and tear. And, you know, it's exciting to be here talking about it, and also exciting for like the full circle of this piece that, you know, nobody really had a place for except for Wanted Design. And I brought it to Wanted Design and showed it. And now almost 10 years later, I'm going to be doing an edition of the same piece with Friedman Benda, which is a really exciting kind of full circle.
What was the reaction when you showed this at Wanted Design 10 years ago?
It was actually very well received. I think people were confused at first because it's not a typology that people are accustomed to seeing. And then people were very surprised with how comfortable it was when they sat down in it. Please don't sit down on it. Okay. But yeah, it was very well received. But again, at the time, it was 2012. You know, it wasn't everybody that liked it also had no idea where it would go. You know, there weren't like galleries coming around looking for stuff like this. And it's not something commercial. So it took great pictures. It ended up in storage.
And I know Jerry from Bernhardt has said in the past that you're a storyteller where product and narrative share equal billing. Can you talk a little bit about that and, you know, what that means in your process and what you like to create?
Yeah. Pretty early on when I was studying design, you know, I got into architecture and design because I kind of had these inherent skill set that leaned toward that. Very mathematical and methodical about the way that I do things, kind of intuitive about space and form. But I think getting to design school, you know, made it pretty clear that there's a potential to have kind of a lack of poetry in the things that I was doing. Sometimes design can be very dry, and that's kind of what tends to separate it from art. You know, when you go into a museum or you go to an exhibition of art, you expect to feel something. But when you're looking at design, too often, you know, you don't have an expectation to feel anything. And I think that was when I started to really think about how I could bring some of that poetry to the things I was making. And I realized that there's something that connects all of us that makes us all kind of have a shared experience that we're having here. And if I could find a way to mine my own personal experiences and translate them into a way that was attractive to other people, then that could be a way to connect them directly to what I had experienced that they've also felt, right? So at that point, I started to realize that the storytelling becomes integral in that process. You can't just put a chair, you know, on the stage and say, look, this is pretty. At a certain point, you have to say, this is why it looks like that. And this is the feeling that goes into it and hope that people can connect to that feeling. And that's where storytelling became, you know, as integral as drawing the lines. And even also important is that there's certain things that you can only explain through stories, which is why mythology is such a big part of the human experience. It's what religion brings us. It's also what you get from having grandparents in your life, right? So being able to kind of express the intangible requires creating a story that somebody can take themselves out of themselves and be empathic with whoever the story is about.
Love that. And what's your process like? How do you sit and create, you know, as you're coming up with these ideas, you know, where do you start?
Coffee. it's a tough question to answer because everything is different. I think one of the things that I've probably done well is that I was always methodical about the skill sets that I was cultivating throughout, you know, the process of becoming a professional. So I would dedicate myself to doing a piece of furniture based on one specific approach. And I did that for like the first 6 or 7 years of school and my career, to the point where now when I do have an idea, I kind of can dig into my toolbox and I know exactly where to start. And I usually don't know where it's going to end, but I know where to start. And sometimes, you know, if I'm trying to express a certain thing, it might start with making a piece of music. Sometimes it might start with, you know, going and sitting in the bathtub for an hour, right? But I kind of have gotten to a point where when there's something that I need to get out, I know where to start. The chairs we're sitting on in the Knoll collection, this was actually the first time since school that I designed like in the traditional way that I learned to design furniture, right? This took me back to when I did the Bernhardt table, where I did my research, had my ideas, and then I sat down and I drew the side profile of what I thought the chair was going to be. And then I just went through hundreds of sheets of trace paper and just changed one thing on each drawing. And then I pasted them all on the wall. And then I went from that until I picked the ones that I like. And then I went to the full scale, pinned it on the wall. Like I did exactly the process that I learned at Art Center about how to design a piece of furniture for the commercial space. And, you know, it's fun to go back to that because for years I've been, you know, kind of just expressing and doing like the stuff that you see in the gallery and all of that. But getting back to kind of the hardcore traditional industrial design process was actually quite fun. Yeah.
That's awesome. Speaking of these chairs, what did you want to create for Knoll? What were you trying to offer that might not already exist for them?
Actually, it's almost the other way around. Like, I wanted to make a classic that's Knoll. If Knoll comes here and says, design something, you have to try to make. So it's not really about bringing them something that they don't have. It's about bringing them something that fits with what they already have, right? So, you know, it's a very personal project in a lot of ways, but also in a lot of ways, it's Knoll, you know, it's not necessarily like just, it's not Eni, that's Eni. Right. This is Knoll and Eni, right? So yeah, it was a lot of research sitting with Benjamin Pardo and having long conversations, sitting in his office and hearing stories about, you know, Florence Knoll and, you know, personal stories about her life and how the company came about. And all of that to me said that there's a story that can be told with a single piece that can kind of encapsulate all of the things that I was getting from Benjamin Pardo about what Knoll is. And that meant that I had to, like, you know, reach into like the, you know, the European roots, the Danish, Scandinavian furniture, the American, like roots, mid-century being kind of like the standout time for American furniture design worldwide, and try to roll that all into a piece of furniture that can just as easily disappear into a space as it can call attention once you pay attention to the details. So, you know, I can't even, with stuff like this, I can't necessarily take credit per se because I have so much history to mine from to come up with this stuff. You know, the approach is new. You haven't really seen like a stacking plastic chair, outdoor chair like this, but all the elements that you see like I've been able to mine them from like a deep, rich history to make it.
I love that. Something that can stand out, but doesn't have to stand out. I love that sentiment. And they're quite comfortable, just FYI, as we sit on them. So you had a lot of history for this chair, but where else do you find inspiration and influence for other part of your work? What do you pay attention to? Or is it just you being out there?
I listen to a lot of music. Like I watch cartoons. So like, I have kind of a solitary life. So I spend a lot of time in my head. I live in Switzerland on a lake, so spend a lot of time just like looking out the window. And I think the biggest thing that I probably draw inspiration from is, I try to tap into things that could be universal. I mean, from like, it's obviously like from a spiritual standpoint, like these universal themes are very important in trying to help people recognize kind of what unifies us. But then also on like purely selfish level, if you make things that a lot of people can understand and like, then you can feed yourself, right? So usually it's when something is coming, it comes from me just really thinking about some kind of strong universal theme or feeling that strikes me and turning it around in my head. So I don't usually have a lot of like references until the idea is fully formed. And then once the concept is fully formed, then I tend to look to nature to see where it's expressing itself. So, you know, when you see the work at Friedman Benda, that stuff is really a combination of philosophy, nature, and spirituality and religious thought that goes into it. And with those things, again, I can't even like take credit for those shapes because it's all stuff that is out there, right?
So let's dive in as you're starting to. Let's start first with the Gallup watch from Hermes. What did you want to create for them? Again, another classic, timeless brand. What did you want to offer for the customer?
Oh, it's similar to Noel. I mean, there's two things. The first thing is that their brief, they were much more direct than Noel. Noel was kind of nice about it. They were like, we want you to make this chair collection. Hermes, they were like, we need you to design the future classic watch for all women. Right?
And no pressure.
Yeah. And they're like, also, we've asked 7 other people to do this. Right. So the real question for me was what is the angle that people aren't looking at? And the first thing that I realized that because they're so traditional, they're like, we need you to make a ladies' watch. And I was like, well, in 2020, you know, or 2019, like, what does that mean, right? When, like, I see women wearing big Rolexes, I see, you know, men wearing, like, dainty vintage watches, right? So I was like, well, first, let's make a feminine watch. And then let's ask ourselves what it means to be feminine in this day and age. And I think the difference between what they had in their collection before and what I had the opportunity to make was that like being feminine in this day and age doesn't mean that the watch is being bought for you by somebody else necessarily. And it also doesn't mean that that it's just a piece of jewelry that you're going to wear while you're, you know, sitting around and relaxing in your, you know, spacious mansion. So I think one of the things that if you actually try on the watch, it's designed with like an aerodynamic sense to it. And I don't know if you wear a watch or not, but when you have these round watches, when you are walking, you need to check the time. You have to stop walking so you don't fall down. Then you have to turn it all the way like this. But I designed this watch so that a woman on the go or a man on the go that's wearing this watch can continue walking and they can read it just like this. And like all of the numbers are going in forced perspective and they're climbing up the watch and they're smaller at the top and larger at the bottom. So in a way, you don't have to lose your momentum, your trajectory. And I think in the modern age, what it means to be feminine and somebody that would walk into Hermes and buy themselves a watch is probably a person that doesn't just like sit around, right? So that was like what I was thinking about for the customer. And then once I started thinking about those things, I needed to make an iconic silhouette, because you recognize a watch by its silhouette. You could be across the room, I would know that's a Rolex because of the silhouette of the watch. So I needed to make an iconic silhouette that touched the brand. So the stirrup, you know, became that shape. Because honestly, I was in the office of Emile Hermès. They have this museum. And when I did all of my research in Paris, I realized that this guy collected so much stuff. But the one thing that like was consistent is that he collected stirrups from every culture around the world. And I don't know if this was what was in his mind, but, you know, I was sitting there being all philosophical and I was thinking at some point, every culture had to ride on the back of an animal and they all created stirrups around the same time, using the same silhouette, even though they had no contact with each other. So I realized this was like a universal shape that could touch every culture, that has been in every culture's history. And somehow it's also emblematic of this brand. So again, wanting to put food in my mouth, I thought this is something everybody should like.
I love that. That's awesome. And then on a larger scale, your recent work at the London Biennial is stunning. And that's really based on storytelling and heritage. Can you tell us a little bit about what you wanted to create?
With the Biennale, it's an interesting thing. I mean, not, especially when I'm in America, I try not to be political. So, but these biennials, they, as much as they bring everybody together, there's an opportunity for there to be some divisiveness in like the nationalistic way that they're approached. I think it's great to celebrate where you're from and celebrate, you know, your heritage and all those things. But when I was asked to participate, I felt like it would have been disingenuous of me to like start waving a flag, you know, like in London for the Biennale. It just didn't feel right. So the way that what did feel right was representing, you know, a culture that I've been a part of everywhere that I've lived in the world. I mean, I've lived in the US, I've lived in Singapore, I've lived in Switzerland. And, you know, the common thread for me and the people that I have this common bond with are the people of the African diaspora. So for me, it made sense that that's what I was going to represent on the world stage. And, you know, at that point, it became important to think about what would be a proper representation of this diaspora that actually doesn't have a flag, that doesn't have any kind of unification in a way, and what would be beneficial to this group of people at this, you know, at this stage. And what became clear is that there hadn't been a world stage for the people of the diaspora to have a unified voice. And beyond, you know, screaming out to the world, you know, like how we feel or anything like that, just having a place to come together and talk to each other more than anything. It's like, how often, you know, do you see people from the US and people from the UK and people from Germany that are all of the African diaspora that aren't having a conversation with each other? They're just having conversations kind of internally. So that was really the goal, is to create something that could travel around the world and give the people of the diaspora a chance to have a conversation. In terms of the form language, because there isn't like a unified diasporic kind of canon to reach into, creates an opportunity to make one up. So I created a mythology. I told a story that hasn't been told before, that's full of magic and mystery. And I pulled objects out of that. So that story had, you know, a magical shell and reverberating sound waves and a disconnected traveling people that need a way to congregate and reach out to each other. And that gave shape to the forms.
What did you make it out of? What materiality did you use?
The one in London is aluminum arches and sailcloth in between and stone as the base. There's meaning behind the materials, but there's also, I mean, I come from an architectural background. There's things that just make sense. So when I decided like how it was going to be formed, I did the entire thing using algorithms of catenary arches, which are, you know, structurally sound, that allowed me to make something 8 meters tall and as slender and elegant as it looked while being strong. And everything just kind of worked out.
And you said the one in London. Is the idea to take it on the road to other places as well?
Yeah. It'll be coming to New York. It'll be in Miami. We're talking to different countries and events where it might go to. And we're adding two more structures.
Awesome. And what was the response like? And also, too, what was it like watching people actually interact with it?
The response was really good. We won Best Design at the Biennale. A lot of times for me, I look at how kids react to things. So I was just happy to see kids like running around it. There's all like, there's a whole bunch of stuff like that happened and events and all that stuff. To me, it's interesting. All that stuff is like documented on the internet and all that. But it was really those moments when you would see a kid just run up and start climbing on it and running underneath it that were special to me.
That's awesome. And we talked a little bit about materiality. You use a lot of different materials, marble, glass, leather. How much of your work is informed by the inherent material properties and characteristics?
I think it's impossible to escape that, whether you're doing it intentionally or not. Like materials, they're the medium that transmits the energy that the object has. Like a form is a form. It's nothing without the materiality. And how somebody feels is based on the materials. I've done this exact same chair with raw wood finish. It's a completely different feeling. And the materials are what transmit that. I think that the materials that I've leaned into have been because they kind of have inherent properties that people have been drawn to forever, right? I think from the moment that somebody made glass, everybody else was like, yo, that shit's awesome. Right? So when I got a chance to work with glass, I was looking at it like, this is crazy, right? Like it's molten now. It's about to be solid. You put colors and the light goes through it. It bends. You look through a piece of glass and you don't even register the fact that everything is upside down when it's coming back at you, right? And we just kind of accept all this magic, you know, and when you start looking at it, you're like, wow, this is magic and I have to do something with it. So from that standpoint, it's almost like a cheat code. I don't feel like I can, you know, like, yeah, I've made stuff with the glass, but the glass is the glass. You know, the material is actually the special thing. All I've done is put it in a way that you might pay attention to the qualities of it that maybe you weren't paying attention to on your day to day.
You've designed so many different products. Is there one, I know it's hard to pick like your favorite, but like, is there one that you like? I mean, from seating to lighting, is there one medium you really love to design or one type of product that you lean towards, or is it just the opportunity to create?
I think usually my favorite product is like either the product I'm currently working on or the last one I did. Because everything before that, I kind of can see all the mistakes in it.
And now you have works in the Met as well, right?
I just had four pieces go into the permanent collection there, which is crazy.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
I don't even, it's wild. That was a crazy project. Hannah Beekler, who's like the Academy Award winning production designer from Black Panther, just like emailed me. her and the Met were doing this period room, and we got on Zoom, and she was like really ecstatic about my work. Somebody at the Met had suggested that it might work for the show, and she felt like it really represented like the Afrofuturist kind of spirit. And we became friends, and we put those pieces in there. I mean, it's still pretty surreal to go into the Met and walk past like big old stuff and then see my stuff there too. It's pretty crazy. But there's a chandelier, a table with solid glass legs, that it's only the second time I've made that one. And then two chairs from the Say collection that we reupholstered with Ruth Carter's textiles from Black Panther 2. And that's pretty cool that they sent me that.
It's an email you don't want to miss.
Yeah, I miss a lot of emails. Claire, no deal, no.
But this one you didn't, which is good. We unfortunately only have like 5 or 6 more minutes. Does anyone have any questions for Eni from the audience before I keep going? Oh, yes, go ahead. The question is, how did you open up your creativity so well across so many different mediums?
Yeah, I think that, it's probably the answer to that probably lies somewhere next to the reason that I can't give an accurate description of my job. I just consider myself to be creative. I think leaning into the design side was a decision, right? So I've kind of been good at anything I've tried creatively. So when I did pottery, I was good at that. I did enameling, I did sculpture, I did a whole bunch of stuff. But then when I dropped out of school and like I was just kind of a, vagrant in life, and I decided that I was going to make something of myself, the question was, all right, if I've lost time and wasted some time, where have I already put in hours? And it was really obvious that, I had an advantage in that I started doing 3D modeling when I was like 11 as a hobby. So I had kind of followed the trajectory of the beginnings of like all the Adobe softwares, and like every Christmas I would ask for new software. So in my mind, I was just like, oh, I like playing on the computer. And then when I dropped out of business school, I was like, oh, I got to do something. And I'm sitting there playing on Photoshop. I was like, what if I make this my job? Right? So it became a decision to move that way. But I didn't learn the tools toward doing this job. I was just always expressing myself. Honestly, most of my Photoshop was just like, I would take my graffiti, scan it, and do cool stuff with it. And all the skills that I learned doing that, I saw could be applied to architecture and furniture. And so I started doing that while I was making music, while I was doing all this other stuff. So honestly, to be creative, I really just need a challenge. And that's why generally my next project is usually something that I haven't done before. So when Hermes comes and says, do you want to do a watch? I'm like, hell yeah. They're like, have you designed a watch before? I'm like, hell no. And then I just do it. And I just don't put any boundaries on it. I think that's key. I think if you're creative in any realm, you can apply it to anything. It's just a matter of like understanding the parameters and what the inputs are, and then coming up with a novel output. That's really all creativity is. It's like, what do you do with these ingredients?
What would you tell yourself 10 years ago here? Like, what would be your advice for somebody else kind of starting out and figuring out their way?
Mark Thorpe told me once. He was like, show up and do dope shit. I don't know if I could give myself better advice than that. I think that, I don't know, a lot of times when like that question is asked, it's like, oh, I would go tell myself, don't worry, it's going to be all right. But like, I don't know. I was pretty confident back then, even though it wasn't working yet. I don't really know what I would tell myself. I think, drink less.
Anyone else? Yes, ma'am. How many projects do you typically work on at one point?
Now, a lot more. I used to really try to do one project at a time. I'm pretty laser focused. And like the Noel collection, when I was doing that, like I focused only on Noel for the beginning couple of months. I put everything in my life to the side and I just focused on this chair, you know, and that's how you, for me at least, I can go from like having an idea to manifesting it well, is to just like start and then finish. Part of my design process now is, even though I have multiple projects, I don't really work on multiple creative things in one day. I usually determine before I go to sleep what I'm going to be working on the next day. And then I focus only on that, to the detriment of my email answering. So even if I'm working on multiple projects, I usually, to be honest, when I'm designing things these days, I usually try to design them in one day. So I'll like do all my research and be prepared. And then when I decide today I'm doing this thing, I do that thing and focus on it. I can't even tell you how many projects are in the pipeline right now, because I need my, you know, my people to help remind me what I need to do next and when the deadline is.
Is there something that's on your bucket list to design that you haven't designed yet?
Temple.
What's next for you? What else are you working on? What are you looking forward to next year?
Whatever the coolest stuff is, I'm not allowed to talk about. I just did a really cool short film with Hassan Rahim, who's an amazing artist, typographer, now director. I'm working with Logitech, and we've got some pretty cool things that we're working on. And one of them is finding creative ways to express some of the most amazing things that they create. And Ultimate Ears is one of the companies that is under their umbrella. And in order to kind of showcase the beauty of what these earbuds can do, during the pandemic, we decided to do like a short film and photo campaign. And that stuff should be coming out soon. I think in the next month or so, you'll probably see it online.
That's so fun. Well, Eni, I can't thank you enough for being here today and sharing your creative process and a little bit about you. So, and thank you all for being here. Hope you had a wonderful ICFF Wanna Design, and enjoy the rest of the day. Thanks for listening to Hospitality Design's What I've Learned. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and review us on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can find full episodes and transcripts at hospitalitydesign.com.